Okay, so how did the ancients use remote viewing, astral projection, lucid dreaming to attain knowledge? Up next, The Power of Myth with John Lash on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. This hour dedicated to Bill in Charlotte, North Carolina, police officer Bill there with his fellow Marines and other officers all around the country. Bill was a Marine and came out around 1996 or so. He's now a police officer down there in Charlotte, North Carolina. Author and teacher John Lash is one of the most forefront exponents of the power of myth to direct and shape an individual's life. John is a lifelong student of world mythology, alchemy, astrology, naked eye astronomy. He's also the co-founder, principal author of metahistory.org. In addition, John founded the Institute for Creative Mythology in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Here he is on Coast to Coast. John, it's been a couple of years since you've been on the program. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's been two and a half, something like that.
Man, it goes by fast, doesn't it, when you're having fun?
Really?
What have you been up to over the last few years?
Well, you know, I finished a big book, which came out in after my interview with you. It came out in November 2007, and since then I've kind of been relieved to get that book done because it was a master task that had about 40 years of my life in it. And so since then, I've been developing some new material and working on the website, metahistory.org, and doing some other creative projects relating to screenplays and kind of edging toward the movie world, actually.
Good for you. We got a lot of response when you were on with us a couple years ago, John, so I'm looking forward to our discussion tonight. In the movie end, is it going to be fact, based on... fiction based on fact, or what's the approach?
Well, the approach is very direct. One of the events in my life that was a quite destiny-shaping event that impacted my whole life was that when I was a young man, around 20, back in New York City at the height of the psychedelic revolution, I met a young girl, and we became very close friends. We were married, and we became good friends for 28 years, and it happens that she was the daughter of a kind of literary icon in the United States named Jack Kerouac. And so through Jan, through knowing her, I now have control of some of the properties of this writer, Jack Kerouac. And I'm developing them into screenplays.
And you're getting some interest?
A great deal of interest, yeah.
Good
the
for you,
primary one that I'm working on right now has a great deal of appeal because it sort of falls into the area of, in a way, the whole Harry Potter kind of genre.
Okay.
Jack Kerouac was most famous, you know, for his novel On the Road.
All right.
And yeah, and he was called the King of the Beat Generation.
His approach. Very unlike most authors, if I recall.
Yeah, he kind of founded a whole style of his own. It's basically a kind of a rambling, some people even say a drunkaholic style. Yeah, because Kerouac's novels, there are about 16 of them, none of them really have much of a story structure. They just kind of ramble on, and he goes from one adventure to another. And he was famous for this kind of style because... it was a very freeing way to write, in the 1950s during the Cold War and in the post-war period. And so he became, as many people know today still, although some people don't know who Kerouac is, he's a major, major literary icon of the 20th century in America. And I'm involved in developing some of the properties that have come to me through my connection, lifetime connection with his daughter, Jan.
That sounds exciting. Well, we look forward to seeing some of these put on the big screen, maybe.
Well, I was just saying there's one of them that kind of relates to the Harry Potter movement. Actually, the favorite book that Jack Kerouac himself wrote, that he said was the favorite of all his books, was kind of a childhood memoir, and it's a fantastic book. It's called Dr. Sacks, and it's a story about his growing up in Lowell, Massachusetts, in a very poor factory town in the 30s. And he, as a young Jackie, who is himself, is a very bright kid. He writes a lot. It's based very much on how he did live and on his true character. But the real appeal of his story, Dr. Sacks, is that young Jackie, this American boy living in the 30s, has an imaginary friend, this wizard named Dr. Sachs. And he has adventures with this wizard, and he and Dr. Sachs and a group of other kids battle the power of evil, who is represented by a great white snake surrounded by these Catholic cardinals. And so the whole story is a fantastic story of kind of like the confrontation between innocence and evil, you could say. And it's a beautiful book for developing a film that has kind of special effects mixed in with real-life kind of footage. I'm sort of thinking of, you remember Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, yeah. Great. Animation with live.
Mixed with real life. And this is how I'm developing Dr. Sachs. I'm working with a colleague and co-writer, Madonna McMagnus, who lives in New York, and she's been sort of acting as a publicity agent for this. And we're developing this screenplay together and actually taking it to Hollywood right now. It would make a fantastic movie sort of on the order of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because the animation of the wizard and his magical and his opponents would go beautifully with the real life footage. It's a great story, very inspiring. And as I said, Jack Kerouac himself said that it was the best thing that he ever wrote, his most beloved work.
Well, look us up, John, the next time you're in Los Angeles, where I spend a lot of my time doing the shows there. So
I sure will. We might be coming into town to talk about the film. It's well in the stage of development. The screenplay is well on the way to being written.
Let's get into some of these incredible areas that you have investigated through mythology and ancients over the years. First of all, how did you get interested in this?
Well, I got interested because as a child I had some kind of supernatural or paranormal experiences. And lucid dreaming, from the age of four. I remember my first lucid dream was at the age of four. And then I had a Kundalini experience. Do you know about that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Some people have reported this, that they don't have to go to yoga school and study under the masters to have the Kundalini experience. It can happen to people spontaneously. That happened to me when I was about 16, and it was extremely traumatic. So basically, I was traumatized by the time I was a teenager, and I went in search of some solution or some understanding of what the heck had happened to me. And the first direction I wandered into was yoga and, Asian mysticism, Asian philosophy, and so forth. And then gradually, I got into mythology and into the various layers of what we call, esotericism.
Did you ever, I went in through the Silva mine studies.
Yeah, Silva mine control, yeah.
Yep, mm-hmm. I love that. I read a book, The Three Magic Words by U.S. Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
That was captivating. In my area, pretty similar, I guess, to yours, just led me into this obsession with trying to get some answers to some of these. But you went even farther back. You went back into the ancient texts and things like that. How far back did you go?
Well, I've gone back about as far as you can go. I mean, as far as you can go right now is only back to about 10,000, B.C., when we pick up from the last ice age. And then we have, of course, we start with archaeological evidence and so forth. And then you come forward, and the first civilization you hit is, of course, Egyptian. So I was deeply involved in the study of Egyptian mythology, and that was the first place where I really started to realize my role as a mythologist, which is pretty much, as you know, how I define myself.
As you began to probe and research these ancients, what are some of the things you started stumbling across?
Well, one of the first things that really impressed me, and it's kind of hard to recreate these impressions because it happens, as you know, when you steep yourself in this material.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen if you're just looking at it superficially. But I'll just tell you what my impression was when I began to study the Egyptians. I got the feeling that they had a knowledge of the sciences, of astronomy, of engineering, certainly, that's obvious.
Yes.
And of languages, an understanding of languages, and also a deep understanding of genetics. And I was asking myself, well, how could they have had this knowledge when they didn't have the kind of technology or the resources that we have today?
Mm-hmm.
And I pondered that question for a long time, as many people have, George. And I think I came to the answer that many people come to, because it is the most obvious answer that you arrive at. if they had knowledge that is equivalent to our technological knowledge, say, in astronomy and genetics today, but they didn't have the computers and the other tools, they must have discovered it through their own inner resources. And that was an amazing revelation for me, because it confirmed for me that I would have the same inner resources as them. And so that's what really put me on the quest. And I would say this hit me when I was maybe 22, 23. That's what really put me on the quest to discover what is inside the human potential that allows us to awaken our divine intelligence.
And do you think by doing that awakening, you're tapping into this force out there and picking up that kind of knowledge?
I think the knowledge that the ancients have had, whether it be the Egyptians, the ancient Chinese, the ancient Polynesians, is kind of floating around in the atmosphere. It's there. It's part of the earth itself. Some of it can be found in nature.
The Mayans probably grabbed it too.
The Mayans grabbed it. Each civilization grabbed it and framed it, you know, in their own particular cultural setting. But it is there. It's always been there. And the great key is, the question that we ask is, apart from just making a theoretical study of what the ancients knew, how do we ourselves tap into that source of knowledge? And so very early on, when I decided to take on the vast subject of mythology, and become a comparative mythologist, that is to say, someone who studies and compares the myths of all the cultures of the world, at the same time that I made that life decision around 22, 23, 24, I also realized I was on an inner quest to tap into this divine wisdom potential that is, I believe, the birthright of our species.
I think so, too. Now, what about the possibility, though? And I agree with this incredible possibility of tapping into this force out there. But what about the possibility that they were told it by an advanced civilization that either came down and visited us or might have already been on the planet?
Well, that's a question that we can go around a rose bush many, many times over that question. So I'll give you just my best shot on that, okay,
right,
George? Just think of this, that if there were more advanced beings, whether they had been human beings who arrived at a higher level of intelligence, or whether they were intergalactic beings or beings from another dimension, just imagine if there were those sorts of beings, and I think there's a lot of evidence they do exist, who could have come and imparted knowledge to humanity. Okay, let's accept that premise. But I would add to that a certain critical criterion. I would say that if those higher evolved beings were compassionate to us and took us on as students, then they would act as good teachers act. And in my opinion, a good teacher does not just spoon-feed the information to his students or her students, but actually encourages the students to learn and develop out of their own potential. And so I accept the idea that we were in, may have been in some ways instructed by higher beings. I mean, many myths say that, you know. But I would qualify it by saying that that is not the only way that we got our information, that we a teacher will make you rely and will show you how to rely on your own resources. So it doesn't totally explain the things that we know.
I could buy that, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a good teacher will just prime you, will be a catalyst for you to discover what you yourself know and what you yourself can do and to realize your own talents. And I do not accept the idea that we were programmed by a higher intelligence and that nothing that we know comes out of our own essential being. I don't accept that. I think the intriguing thing is to understand what part of it comes out of us as compared to what part of it might have been imparted to us. You know, that's an intriguing question.
You know, I'm also puzzled by the lack of the physical evidence of, for example, if we believe that the pyramids were constructed with incredible knowledge.
Yeah.
That where are the tools? You know,
really.
And where are all these things?
Yeah.
What do they do with them?
That is really baffling. I mean, where are the engineering tools that they constructed those buildings with? You know, you have to. It's exasperating. But you almost have to fall back on you know, the premise of some kind of magical technology that they used. For instance, as you Well, no, I'm sure. One explanation of how the pyramids was built is that they were they used a sonar, some kind of sonar devices to move these stones. And there was a famous early explorer who went to Tibet in the 30s and left a record of his experiences there. And he claims to have seen Tibetan monks do just exactly this, using trumpets to create a vibrational field that was like a platform. And then on that platform, they moved very, very heavy stones. So you kind of have to fall back on that that explanation, unfortunately, because the fact is there is no evidence of what tools they did use. You know?
Of these ancient areas, John, that we're going to talk heavily about tonight, was there one area, whether it was remote viewing, astral projection, lucid dreaming, was there one area that impressed you the most that the ancients possessed?
Really good question there. You mean one particular faculty, one particular path of investigation?
That was so strong, and maybe so baffling.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I strongly believe that, you know, in the ancient shamanic seers had a profound connection with the sky. And I believe, as we know, you know, all these great megalithic structures, like from Stonehenge to the Angkor Wat in Southeast Asia, to the Pacific Islands, to the Medicine Wheel circles and stone circles in the United States, to Stonehenge and so forth, all of these great mysterious megalithic structures are aligned to the sky, aren't they? All of them.
Sure, absolutely.
And so what really impresses me is that the ancients had a visual and cognitive interface with the sky. They could read it and they could use it somehow to orient themselves to everything they did on Earth in their engineering feats, but also everything they did in their social and cultural activities. Because most of the great myths that they used, for instance, in Egyptian mythology, the myths of Seth and Horus, are all related to the stars. Osiris is the constellation of Orion. And there is hardly one myth anywhere in the world that cannot be related to the sky. So what impressed me most was this human mind-sky interface. And I wanted to explore that. And that is why I have become known, and happily to say so, as somewhat of an authority or expert on naked eye astronomy and the understanding of archaeoastronomy and the myths of the stars. That has been a great, great passion in my life. And I believe that in the star connection, there is a connection between the skies and the human mind, but you have to experience it. It's very hard to describe theoretically.
I bet even with today's technology and incredible abilities, the Hubble and everything else that we use, I bet we've only scratched the surface of knowledge and where we're probably going to be at 100 or 200 years from now, don't you think?
Well, in terms of astronomy, that's certainly so. You know, I gave a talk at the London Astronomy Show some years back, and I must say people were absolutely stunned by my opening point in that talk. I raised the idea that we now have these orbiting telescopes and infrared telescopes, and we have all this high-tech gear to explore the universe, right? And we're gathering all this data. And it was only about in the early 80s, using this data, that we were able to ascertain the direction that you look to the galactic center.
It took that long. John, let's talk more about that when we come back, as well as an update on angels and mind parasites and some other things on Coast to Coast AM. Just got an email from someone who says, "Oh, George, I've been working like 15 hours a day. I want to stay up for the show. I'm exhausted. I got to go to bed. What can I do?" Well, I just sent him back an email that said, "You might want to consider Streamlink, where you can get podcasting in the morning." And I think he'll like it when he finally reads the email. You can pick up Streamlink, too, for just pennies a day by going to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for it and get podcasting and downloads. And Lex tells me they are pushing forward to expanding that 90-day download of past shows as well. So well worth it for you. We'll be back in a moment with John Lash on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, John Lash, our special guest tonight. And John, you were telling us about this speech on astronomy. It's a great story. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me wind up the second half of that. I was saying that due to all this gear we have now, scientists about in the early 80s, I believe, astronomers were able to say in the location looking out into the galaxy, if you look in this direction, a certain direction of space, you're looking toward the center of our galaxy, which we know we're in this vast galaxy of 200 billion stars, which is like a rotating whirlpool. And they said, well, you can't see the center, but if you look in this direction, it's a sight line, okay? And that sight line is located in about 27 degrees of the sign Sagittarius in the zodiac. And so I pointed out, is my opening point in this talk at the London Astronomy Show, that that's a very recent big, big piece of information about the structure of the cosmos, right? We know where to look, where the center of our galaxy is. But if you go look at the ancient constellations that are in that area, what do you see? Well, there is a constellation there called Sagittarius, the Archer. And it is a group of stars, and I have to point out, make a very important point here, that when you look at this group of composite stars of the Sagittarius, the Archer, it doesn't look like an archer. It doesn't immediately suggest, oh, that's what you see, like dot to dots.
Yeah.
The trick is, George, that you would have to be instructed to visualize it as an archer. What the ancients did is they instructed people to visualize these composite stars as the archer. And if you do that, they say this star is the hand of the archer holding the arrow, pulling it back. These stars make the bow. These stars form the arrow. This star is the tip of the arrow. Well, guess what? The tip of the arrow and the direction that the arrow is pointing is exactly the location of the galactic center.
Is that incredible?
That's right. And I started that out, and that got their attention. And then I went on to give them seven other examples of the same kind of thing, that the constellations are pictures that they must be intentional pictures, because when you actually look at them, they don't suggest these animals immediately to the naive imagination. They're intentional pictures indicating that people were shown to look at the sky in a certain way. And by doing so, they were shown aspects of cosmic structure, which we've only discovered in the last 20, 30 years.
That is amazing.
Is it possible? And then again, going back to the beginning, and I love the way you opened our conversation, because you really come right down to the point. It's like, well, it's great that the ancients knew all these things, but how did they know them, and how can we know them as well? Okay? Mm-hmm. So I had a very key moment when I was riding on a boat in the China Sea from Yokohama down to Singapore, and I met this German aristocrat, this very rich German guy who was traveling, and he was reading this book called The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramhansa Yogananda. Don't know if you've heard that name.
I sure have. Absolutely.
Yeah, he was one of the first yogis who came to the United States and brought yoga and Indian wisdom over here. Mm-hmm. You know, he was before the guru of the Beatles and all those people.
The Maharishi, right?
Yeah, he was before the Maharishi. Anyway, he wrote this book in 1945. And so I was reading this book on this boat that this stranger, total stranger, had very kindly given to me. I come to this chapter. I just go, wow, wait a minute. Yogananda is being instructed by his master, Sri Yukteswar, in the practice of what is called samadhi, or high-level cosmic attention. And his guru explains to him, Yogananda, if you practice this as the yogis do, you can see at infinite distances. You can actually see the galaxy and the structure of the galaxy with your own eyes. So I thought, hey, here we go. Here is proof from an ancient Indian tradition that we have extraordinary faculties, and those must have been the faculties that the ancients used when they constructed visually these constellations, you know?
I would have loved to have been there, John, just to witness how their mindset worked. Fascinating.
Well, they have the ability, and you can learn this from Yogananda, because he's one of the inheritors of this very, very ancient tradition. They have the ability to take what we call the simple power of attention. And, you know, when you sit down to drive a car, you have to apply attention. When you sit down to solve a mathematical problem, you have to apply attention. And some things require high, high level of attention. And apparently, or not apparently, but certainly what these ancients were able to do was to develop their powers of attention to an extraordinary degree that absolutely defies what we consider to be the bounds of the human mind. And they were able to look into the outer structure of the cosmos. They were able to look into the inner molecular structure of matter. And the yoga manuals describe in detail these faculties and how to attain them.
You have done some work into an incredible area about, they're called, and if I'm pronouncing this right, archons?
Yeah, the archons, yeah.
Archons. What are they exactly?
Well, archon is just a Greek word that was very common back in the Christian era, and actually it really meant governor or boss. For instance, each area of the Roman Empire, as you know, was very tightly controlled by the central authority, and so they would have an archon for the area of Palestine or an archon for the area of Alexandria, who was the governor of that. But in a different sense, in a metaphysical and parapsychological sense, this word archon was used to refer to alien mind parasites. And it was used in specific manuscripts written in Coptic and Greek that were lost almost entirely until they were discovered in around 1945. And so if you go into this material, which is called Nag Hammadi, because it was discovered at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, mm-hmm. you find in here the behavior, the appearance, and the motives of these archon or archontic beings very precisely described. And it is absolutely unmistakable that this is a record of what we call ET encounters, alien abduction, the whole theme of the alien intrusion into the genetics of the human race, the attempt to meddle in our genetics. It's all there in these documents. So we'd say 2,000 years ago, when these date from, the seers and shamans of that period were actually able to detect these ETs. They weren't just having random encounters with ETs. They were actually going out and tracking them down and learning their behavior, and they wrote down their behavior, and it's absolutely remarkable to read. There's a great deal of it on my website, as you know, metahistory.org, where I've commented a lot on these particular texts, because to my knowledge, they are the texts that give the most explicit description of alien intrusion, ET, UFO kind of stuff.
And I doubt it was the vivid imagination of the author of the time.
No question about it. It couldn't have been, because the evidence that they give, if you want to call it evidence, how do you know that something is evidence and it's not just fantasy, right? Good question. Well, I call it evidence because it matches so closely the current evidence that we have from the best researchers and analysts, such as Jacques Vallée and John Keel and so forth.
And I love Jacques Vallée. He's a regular guest
brilliant,
on the program.
Brilliant, yeah.
Super. And his mindset change. His mindset change.
The control program is very connected with what the ancients, how the ancients described these archons, that they are perpetrating a spiritual control program on our minds. It's really, I don't know if I can use this word on the site, but it's really a mind F.K. This is what they do. And it's described brilliantly in these texts.
Do you remember the movie? Now I forgot it. The one with Richard Dreyfuss.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah. Jacques Vallée was highlighted in that movie. The Frenchman was truly supposed to be him.
Yeah, the Frenchman Truffaut, who was a director of French films, played Jacques Vallée, and he's in the opening scene. Yeah.
But he has changed his mindset over the years. He's gone from straight physical ETs to more dimensional creatures.
Yes,
and
I know he has. I know that. And that's also consistent with what you find in these Nag Hammadi materials from the desert of Egypt. You know, they do not describe them. They say that they are entities who can, they are shapeshifters. And they are entities who can, at moments, insert themselves, say, temporarily and often bizarrely, in our three-dimensional matrix of space and time. But essentially, they are not of this planet, they are not of the Earth, and they can't really establish themselves here. So one of the interesting conclusions that I drew, and I hold strongly to this position, from those writings is that these Archon ETs cannot really, they're not really capable of invading the Earth because the atmosphere of the Earth is actually hostile to them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they need to be in a friendly atmosphere.
Live outside in the solar system, and this is not my supposition. This is exactly what the texts say. The texts say that the Archons live in the solar system of planets exclusive of the Earth, and that they are inorganic, or what we now would call cybernetic, cyborg entities. They are inorganic entities because the Earth is the only planet in the solar system, our solar system, which has an organic life matrix, as you know. The other planets are inorganic, and that's where the Archons live, according to these ancient texts.
Might these be fallen angels?
No, I don't think so. Okay. You know, the fallen angel mythology is fascinating, and a lot of people have done some interesting work with it, you got to admit. But if you would ask me as a comparative mythologist, if the profile of these Archon mind parasites fits a fallen angel mythology, I would say it doesn't really match. I think the fallen angels are part of another interdimensional manifestation, you know? Our species is in touch. We are not alone. I mean, I'm
far from being alone.
I say that on this program, am I?
Well, you won't be the last either.
No, we are not alone. And particularly, we're not alone in our own minds. I mean, that to me is the real dazzling message of this Nag Hammadi stuff. We are not alone in our own minds. And the danger, and this is also what Jacques Vallée says, the danger of the UFO phenomenon is whether or not the ETs are real in a physical sense, doesn't matter. It's the effect, the queering and warping effect that they have on our minds that matters. That's why he describes them as interdimensional beings who affect our perception more than anything else.
Are they all benevolent?
Well, this is another interesting question, too, and boy, you have to look at this one very carefully. I'll just tell you what I have found in these materials.
Okay.
They're very obscure Coptic materials, and they're not easy to read. You have to really delve into them with a fine-tooth comb. But
And do they do some pictures? Do they depict anything with pictures, or is it just
no,
all
there
text?
Are no pictures in them. They're just written text. They okay. sometimes have kind of magical diagrams in them, you know, like you would find in a medieval book of magic,
yeah.
kind of stick drawings and circles.
Yeah.
Anyway, there are some even more obscure Coptic manuscripts that were not discovered at this fantastic cache that they found in Egypt. And if you go and look in them, you find a very interesting point made, which says that the Archons, there are millions of them, and they inhabit the solar system. They live on the other planets, and they fly among the planets. Their ability to fly through interplanetary space is very clearly defined, okay? Because the lord of these Archons is called by a very bizarre name, which means Yeldabaoth. And Yeldabaoth means the one who passes freely through space. It also means, very interestingly, the one who appears to be a child. And so that really points me to the grays to me, because, you know, a gray, what does a gray look like? It looks like an undeveloped embryo, right? It looks like a prematurely born being.
So bald, everything.
Yeah, bald with a funny limb. So the one who appears like a child who moves freely through space. But it says that a very odd thing happened in the early evolution of our solar system, and that is that a segment of these Archons split off and defected and became benevolently oriented toward the human race. And these Archons are given a really strange name, which no scholar of this material has ever been able to explain. And I love this name. It's very odd. The name is Paralimptor.
Paralimptor.
Paralimptor. Paralemptor. And it's a strange name because it begins with para, okay? Now, you want to think of something like paralegal, or paramedic. The Paralemptors is the name given in these ancient texts to the benevolent Archons. Now, scholars are baffled by this word because it's not a real word in Greek. It's like a made-up word. And so they usually translate it as receivers, the receivers. Now, this is very mysterious stuff, George. Very few people know about this, and I would imagine that all kinds of people have talked on your program, and maybe you've never heard this mentioned before.
I've never heard this before.
This is what they say.
All right.
They say that a portion of these archontic beings, these cyborg entities who inhabit the solar system but not the Earth, defected and became benevolently oriented toward the Earth. And they went to the sun. And they live in the area, in the atmosphere of the sun. And one of their roles is to receive people when they die. And that's why they're called the receivers.
Interesting.
And so the benevolent, and I wrote about this on my site, and a number of people wrote into me and said, this is remarkable. I've never heard this before, because when I was dying, I had a near-death experience, or when a friend of mine did, they told me that they saw some kind of ET or Archon entities receiving them in that tunnel of light.
Huh.
And so if there is, I'm not saying that I have the full scoop on this, you know, this is a very weird scenario we're talking about here, but if there is an element of benevolently oriented archons, then it would be these receivers. This is how they're described.
John,
beings who help us die, essentially.
Any other civilizations, any of them, talk about this?
I have to tell you, this is completely unique material, which only is found in three very rare Coptic manuscripts, one of which is called the Pistis Sophia, or the faith of
right.
Sophia. The other one is called the Treatise of Our Great Cosmic Power and so forth, or the Bruce Codex. Very, very rare. I've never seen it anywhere else. But of course, you know that if you go now, when you find a weird anomalous information like this, this is what I do. When I go and I look at any, are there any myths from anywhere in the world that would seem to confirm this? Well, yeah, I can give you two examples. The receivers seem to resemble what the Hopis call the Kachinas of Hopi religion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Kachinas, as you know, are these spiritual beings who are part of the Hopi worldview, and they are involved also with receiving us and helping us make the transition from life through death into other worlds, you know, because those people don't believe that we don't die, really. Death is just a transition to other worlds. So the Hopi Kachinas would seem to fit the profile of the receivers. And then on the other hand, if you look at Egyptian mythology, and there's a great deal of after-death information in there, isn't there? The Egyptians were totally fascinated what happens to us in the death process and after death. And once again, there seems to be an indication that there are ritualized, kind of stiff, odd, ritualized beings who appear at a certain point and usher people through or receive them into the death experience. So there are some parallels to this very obscure material.
Didn't the Pistis Sophia also say that, you know, after Jesus died, he remained on earth after his resurrection for 10, 11 years, something like that?
Yeah, for almost 12 years, and gave instruction to his disciples. And then after he ascended in an ascended body, he also gave telepathic instruction to his disciples, which was mainly received, as you know, by guess who? Mary Magdalene, who is called in the Pistis Sophia the equal to Jesus and the one who knew all. And she is actually the one who channels the Pistis Sophia. You know, of course, that the Pistis Sophia is like a piece of channeled material. It was channeled by Mary Magdalene, of all people, you know? But that story is very typical of a lot of stories of ascended masters. And, you know, it's not particularly restricted to the Jesus, the story
right.
of Jesus. Yeah.
Hey, John, we're going to take this quick break. Then we'll be right back with you on Coast to Coast AM.